everybody. My name is Leslie, and I'm an alcoholic. I was so worried I wouldn't be able to see over this podium. I thought I'd be just a little sober floating head. I want to thank Jim for asking me. It just worked out so beautifully. Tomorrow's my natal birthday. I'll be 52. And I have identical twin sisters that work at the Laguna Cliffs Marriott. And so it just worked out beautifully. I happened to be in town. I've been blessed with a huge life in sobriety, and I travel quite a bit. And he sent me a lovely email, and I said, you know, I think not only am I'm in town, I think I'm in Laguna that weekend. So it was just meant to be. I want to welcome everybody new. I can't think of a better way to either kick off your sobriety or come back to the program than a conference. I want to welcome all our Al-Anon friends. I found Al-Anon when I was 5 years sober. I fell in love with a newcomer. And I would call my sponsor and I would tell him, you know, it's so sweet. We sleep in the same bed. We don't have sex, but, you know, we just cuddle. And my sponsor is Don Norman, who is he's 73-year-old African-American queen that tells you, he calls me precious one, and then he lowers the boom. But I told him, I said, you know, I've got this newcomer and it's so sweet. You know, we sleep in the same bed. And he said, what? And this newcomer was not only an alcoholic and a crystal meth addict, he was also a sex addict. So he would go in and out of the program. And I find myself cruising the parking lots of the sex clubs looking for his truck when he would go out. And I had decided that I was just going to give up a year of my life to help this boy. And that's all it took for Don to say, you know what, baby, you need to go to Al-Anon. And, you know, I learned, it's a wonderful thing. I don't see how anybody in the world can sponsor without having some Al-Anon under their belt. You know, because I learned in that program, it's a gentler language. It took me a while to hear the program of Al-Anon. But I learned that when I give my power to another person, I'm in trouble. You know, when my happiness depends upon another human being, I'm in trouble. And I highly recommend it, especially if you're sleeping, you know, with your sponsees. But not sex. See, we weren't having sex. We just cuddled. But I really did. I ended up in a fetal position on the bathroom floor. And I remember thinking to myself, I have worked too hard to get sober to feel this bad. And I have to also tell you, getting over the addiction to another human being was much harder than getting off the drugs and the alcohol. It really was. Especially at 5 years of sobriety where you have no outlet at all, but no choice but to sit through that pain. And I didn't think I could take it. I really did not think that I could take that pain. And I learned, you know, wonderful things in Al-Anon. But anyway, through the fellowship that I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, which replaced the fellowship of the Spotlight Lounge. If you don't know the Spotlight Lounge sits in downtown Hollywood. You go through strips of carpeting, I don't know, to get in to the Spotlight Lounge. And the Spotlight Lounge, the denizens of the Spotlight Lounge are young, rough boys, about, I'd say, 30 days out of Soul Dad. They have chipped teeth, tattoos, dirty fingernails. They have $40 rock cocaine habits. And there I sat with a cocktail and a checkbook for because most of these boys were willing to do anything for that $40, and there I sat. And, you know, in retrospect, it wasn't about sex. Rent boys are a big part of my story, even in sobriety. But, paying these young men, it was never, ever about sex. You know, I was also a crystal meth addict. I drank. I couldn't sleep. And it would scare me that I was going to have to go home alone. And I knew I wouldn't be able to get to sleep. And I would pay these boys to come home and sit with me till I fell asleep. And then they'd rob me. Every time. And I'm talking television sets and, you know, family silverware and you know. They would rob me, and then I would forget which ones had robbed me, and I would take the same one home again. You know? So now he'd have a TV and a VCR. So. But, you know, I was so isolated, I just needed, you know, human companionship. My life had narrowed down to vodka and snorting crystal meth in my bedroom all alone. I was peeing in a jar because I was afraid to go down the hall of my own home because you never know, you know. And I was the curtain monitor for about 10 years, you know. I would peep. I had shifts, you know. There was like the morning shift and then there was the evening shift, and I was just deep into my disease, but through the fellowship that I found in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, which replaced the fellowship of the tweakers, through rigorously working the 12 steps to the very best of my ability, and through on a daily basis seeking a power greater than myself, for this alcoholic, seeking being the operative word. That'll probably be the thrust of my talk because that's been my struggle. You know, that has been my struggle. I think I walked into this program. Well, through all of that, I haven't had a drink and I haven't had a line of crystal meth since October 20th, 1997. So you know, that's 9 years in remission. That's 9 years in remission from this disease that we suffer from. But I walked into the program. I don't think I'll get into a big drunk log because I have one story that just sums it up. I used to love to drink in the daytime because it was just so naughty. There was something so naughty about drinking in the daytime. And I loved to start drinking around noon, and I would go up to this place called the Café des Trois, which is in West Hollywood, better known as the Café des Twat, because of the evil old queens that drink there. But I was a chicken in that bar, but I, you know, I would begin my day with a little cocktail at the Café des Trois, and, you know, I would... sit there and try to convince some lounge lizard, you know, who had not seen the light of day or television in 20 years, impress him that I had once guested on Murphy Brown. But I would start my day at the Café des Trois, and then I remember I got really, sometimes, you know, it just would happen. You're just drunk, and you don't know how it happened, and you know, you're thinking, I got to make it to happy hour, and here, I don't know what. So my best idea was, I thought, well, if I can find a little bump of crystal, I can go on through happy hour. And so I went on the hunt, and I ended up at this bar, and somebody gave me, you know, some crystal meth, and I was going to go in the bathroom and do a little bump of that. And I don't know what they gave me, but I walked out of there like I'd been plugged in to that. I walked out of the bathroom, and there were these two evil queens laying against the bar there, and one of them goes, I heard them, I overheard them. One of them goes, oh, here she comes. The drug-crazed sex dwarf. Now, here is the really sick part. I kind of liked that. You know, to be that notorious. Perhaps you've heard of me. The sex craze. What is it? Drug craze sex dwarf? But, you know, that just sort of summed it up. You know, there I was, just the drug craze sex dwarf. And so... I grew up in the Deep South. I don't know what your first clue would be, but I grew up in the Deep South, and I sort of fell out of the womb and landed in my mama's high heels, and my daddy was a lieutenant colonel in the Army, and I was not exactly the son that he envisioned. And so, you know, my mother and my grandmother, I think, took one look at little Leslie, and they thought, oh, he's going to need some help. And they circled the wagons, as only good Southern women can do, and they created this little secret garden where it was okay for little boys to play with dolls. It was okay for little boys to read Trixie Belden and Nancy Drew instead of those rambunctious Hardy Boys. It was okay for little boys to sew doll clothes and to make pot holders. You know, it was okay for this little boy to do whatever he wanted except, shh, shh, no, honey, let's don't show Daddy. So I just sort of instinctively knew from a very early age that whatever it was I was or whatever it was I did was somehow shameful. You know, I really do feel that I fell out of the womb afraid and ashamed. And, you know, it was not until I got into recovery at 42 years of age that I realized every decision I have ever made as an adult was either shame or fear-based. You know, and my daddy, you know, he was a good man. He was a loving man. He just didn't know what to make of me. I wanted, my first aspiration that I can remember, I wanted to be a go-go dancer. There was this television show called Hullabaloo, and I was just transfixed. And so I pushed all the furniture back in the living room, and I commandeered the coffee table. And I had one 45, you know, it had that little plastic thing that you'd put in it, and you'd turn the thing from 33 to 45, and then and it was Wipeout by the Safaris. And I had learned, you know, all the dances, and my poor daddy would come home, and I would be on that coffee table, you know, Daddy, watch me do the pony. And I And my daddy used to call me son as if he was in deep pain. He would just say, oh, son. And my mother was a champion baton twirler. And so I remember one time mother got out. I mean, I was probably 6 years old, 7 years old, and we got out in the front yard with her baton. And she taught me this routine, and I was really good. I mean, I really good at it. I could throw it under my legs. I could spin, and I could catch it and do that pose and everything. And my daddy comes pulling up with all of his Army buddies. And my voice is high and squeaky now, but when I was a little kid, I had the highest little squeaky voice. And I said, Daddy, Daddy, watch me twirl. And I remember his face to this day. He said, son, why don't you twirl in the house? And I said, well, Mama's scared I'll break something. You know? And I remember he said, son, I'll pay for whatever you break. But you know, my daddy was killed in a plane crash, a really horrendous plane crash when I was 11 years old. And it's a really hard time for a boy to lose his father anyway. And I was 11 years old, and I just knew to the very core of my being that he went to his grave ashamed to have a son like me. And, you know, at 11, I still didn't quite know what like me meant. And I remember thinking, as I got older, if I could just get out of Tennessee, if I could just get out and away from the lies of that Baptist church, if I could just, you know, if I could find people like me, I'm going to be okay. Well, I end up in West Hollywood. There's queers hanging from the trees. And do you know, I think the loneliest I have ever been was sitting at the Gold Coast, you know, on Santa Monica Boulevard, coming off a six-day bender, just trying to get enough alcohol in me where I could go home and sleep, surrounded by people like me. And I do not think that it was until I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous at 42 years of age that I exhaled for the first time in my life. I remember thinking, my God, it has nothing to do with the fact that I grew up a little fag in the hills of Tennessee with a dad that I felt I was a disappointment to. It has nothing to do with the fact that, you know, I've been baptized 14 times. It never did take. You know, it just... But it has nothing to do with, you know, the Baptist church. It has nothing to do... It's the fact that I am an alcoholic, you know. And it wasn't until I found gay alcoholics that I feel that I truly found my tribe, you know. Because I remember when I was doing my fourth step, my sponsor said to me, I had 80 resentments. And my sponsor said, you know, Leslie, all of these are people. You can resent places. You can resent things. And I didn't know what he was talking about. It just didn't. I said, what do you mean? I wrote down, I resent West Hollywood. It was like the floodgates. You know, because when I go from Doheny Boulevard to San Vicente, in that area of West Hollywood, even in sobriety, I have never felt a part of. I've always felt less than. You know, I felt judged. I was never, you know, I used to think it was, and I don't know what it's like because I don't go to bars anymore, but in my day, you know, you went to a bar to get a trick. That's what you went to the bar for. And if you were going to get a trick, you couldn't be all Nelly. You know, nobody wanted to trick with a sissy. So we had to, here I am in cowboy boots and, you know, a belt buckle you could serve a turkey on. And I'm thinking, how sad that we can't even be ourselves around our tribe. You know, we are more judged by our gay friends than anybody, you know. And so I wrote, you know, that out. And even to this day, you know, when I go to West Hollywood, I just never felt what people think, you know, when they say I found gay people and I found my tribe. This is my tribe. You know, this is my tribe, gay alcoholics, and I'm so blessed. You know, I think because of my job and because I do, I'm good at this. I'm good at getting up in front of people because it's my job. I get to go all over the country, you know. I get to go all over the country and talk to gay alcoholics. And I, you know, I feel so blessed because I think, and I find it more in gay AA. You know, I actually got sober in straight AA. I'll get to that. But I'm sort of glad that I got sober there because gay men, I'm not sure if it's the same with gay women, but gay men, we don't know how to socialize. We know how to sexualize. You know, but I think it's because we grew up with a secret. We don't know how to just put our hand out and look you in the face and say, hey, my name is Leslie, welcome to AA, with nothing attached. You know, and I learned how to do that. I learned how to do that in straight AA, you know. I'll tell you a quick story. Right after I got sober, right after I did my fourth step, my sponsor said, you know, Leslie, he was this Irish straight guy that I got to, he was my first sponsor because he was really cute. And but he taught me a lot, and this is what he did for me that I think, you know, I will be thankful for forever. He said to me, Leslie, you know, it seems to me your biggest fear are groups of heterosexual men. And I said, well, no shit. It wasn't exactly a picnic during dodgeball, you know. Smear the queer. And I had to tap dance or get creamed, you know. I had this fantasy, though. You know what? I was thinking not too long ago, and dodgeball is where I learned to be funny because, you know, I could keep the bullies at bay. That's the only way I could keep the bullies at bay because I was such a little sissy. And during dodgeball, and there was this one kid, I had this fantasy, I get to go back to Chattanooga, Tennessee, where I grew up, and find that Agnew kid. You know, there's always that one, that Agnew kid, who just tormented me, you know. I would have welts after dodgeball. And I want to go up to him and say, you know, I want to thank you because, you know, because of you, I learned to be really funny, and I've, you know, I've had a huge career, you know, huge big career, and, you know, I just want to tell you to kiss my very rich gay ass. Yeah. for teaching me. But anyway, I'm all over the place. But back to my sponsor said to me, you know, your biggest fear seems to be these groups of heterosexual men. And he said, Leslie, I highly suggest that you join a men's stag. And I remember I thought I was going to shit and just fall back in. The thought, because I said, can I join a men's stag in West Hollywood? He goes, you have no fear of those men. I want you to go. I went over the hill into the valley to the Radford Hall on a Monday night. The testosterone in that room, they don't sing happy birthday. They go, ooh, 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 ooh. And here were these great, big, huge, straight men. And I forgot to leave my MERS, my male purse. I love that term. I had my MERS in the car, and all of a sudden I'm in the midst of them. And so I just sort of scurried to the front and took a seat. And I remember thinking I was actually shaking, you know, like a little chihuahua. I was so scared, and it was a meeting that had a podium, and they asked me, they said, would our newcomer like to share? And I remember this story that I heard. I have a friend in Texas, Mark C., who really is, he is the most effeminate man I know. He makes me look like a Hell's Angel. I mean, when Mark C. first got sober, he had to speak at a straight meeting. And he called his sponsor and he said, do you think that I should just tell him right off the bat I'm gay? His sponsor said, honey, you got to walk to the podium. They'll know. But that story popped into my head and I thought, how am I going to get from there to the podium? And I remember I stood at the podium. And I looked out, and all those big, you know, I just saw my dad and all his buddies, you know. I saw my dad and all his army buddies on the faces. And the most cathartic thought, I remember I thought, you know what? This is the jumping off point right here. It's like when you were a kid and you went up, finally got enough nerve, and you got up on the high board, and you're looking down. And you think, I'm not going to make those kids back down that ladder. You know how you had to do if you were like a big sissy and everybody had to back down the ladder. I said, I'm not, you know, and this was the jumping off point. And I took a deep breath and I said, my name is Leslie. I'm an alcoholic. I'm also a drug addict. But more importantly, I think for me and my sobriety right now, I need to say that I'm a homosexual. And I waited because I just knew somebody was going to snicker and go, you know, no shit. But I, you know, for the first time in my life, I think I told the truth to a group of heterosexual men. And I have to tell you that the love in that room, it was so overwhelming. I had the mistaken idea, guys, that heterosexual men did not have fear or shame. I never saw it in my dad, you know. I'm sure it was. Let me tell you, the emotional landscape of the heterosexual male is a minefield of fear, shame. You know, I would sit there and listen to these guys tell their stories with tears, you know, just the shame of it all and the fears that they had. And I would forget to breathe. There was one time I hyperventilated. I thought, oh, great, you know, the queer is going to, like, faint into the floor. Help him up, boys. You get his MERS. But you know, I became an integral part of that group. I was there for the first probably 3 to 4 years of my sobriety. That was my home group. And thank God it was a group that was based upon the 10th step. I learned to be myself in front of those men. And that's so weird. I mean, you'd think that we would learn that in gay AA to get around, you know. But for this alcoholic, it didn't work that way. I learned how to be myself. I learned, which is so hard for me to say, that being a man has very little to do with how far you can throw a football, you know, how many women you've bedded, how much weight you can lift. Those men taught me that I have a code in which I live my life by, and as long as I adhere to that code, I'm a man. You know, I'm a sober man today. And I'm, you know, it's at something that I thought I would go to my grave. You know, my daddy was in possession of this, it was this easy kind of masculinity that I am in awe of. I'm terrified. I'm real attracted to, but we're not going to go down that road. We would never find our way back. But I see guys that have that easy kind of masculinity, you know, that where it's, you know, and I think, God, it's all I can do to get down the street, you know, without someone whistling or, you know, I'm no longer a failure, because one of those men pulled me aside and he said, "I've had something made up for you." I thought this was so sweet. He had made up a card that said, "What you think of me is none of my business." And he had me wear that in my wallet. You know, I think as gay people, we're so self-conscious. I don't know what that's about. You know, you see people that just seem to go through life and they just got it down, and gay, alcohol, I don't know what it is. I don't know what makes me like that, you know. See, all my life, my mother used to tell me from the time I was a little boy, my mother would say, "Leslie, honey, it is not always about you." And the three times that I've attempted any kind of long-term relationship, they've all three walked out the door. "Leslie, honey, I love you, but it's not always about you. You exhaust me. You exhaust me." And I always thought, I wanted to scream and say, no, to be self-absorbed, you have to think highly of yourself. You know, no. The most self-absorbed people on this planet are people who are consumed with self-loathing. We really cannot see past that. We're exhausting. We are exhausting. I lived in an apartment for years that had no mirrors. I couldn't even bear. I broke in a drunken rage, broke the mirror out in my bathroom because I caught myself shaving with my pinky out. I thought, "You are such a fag, you can't even shave like a man." And so, but I, you know, my journey into sobriety has been this amazing journey into my queerdom. You know, if you had asked me when I was 42 years old, are you openly gay? You know, please, honey, I did. You know, people used to ask me, when did you come out, Leslie? Honey, you have to have been in to come out. You know, I don't know when I. And now I say, you know, when I came out, I started coming out October 20th, 1997, because you took away my medicine. And I was riddled with internal homophobia. That same sponsor said to me, he said, "Leslie, you're a fag-hating fag." And I said, "Oh, no, honey, I don't hate fags. I hate Nelly fags." He said, "Hello." But I think when we see in others, you know, something that we just is so deep within us, that self-loathing. And who can blame us? I mean, what's the worst thing that a kid can call a kid? You queer, you fag. You know, I grew up, you know, and with just, you know, the self. But when I got into the program is when I finally began, you know, I started smoking pot and drinking when I was 14 years old, and that's when it started hitting me about being a homosexual. And I think all of that shame, all of that fear, all of that rage was just stuffed for, what, 30-some-odd years. I get sober, and I am just raw. I didn't know how to act in a social situation. I had also used shot speed, I'll just say it, intravenously shot speed. I hate saying it, but I did anyway. So I had been shooting speed for so long that my synapses were not firing correctly. and I couldn't speak. I was rendered mute, which is so odd because I'm so verbose and outgoing now. I could not speak when I got sober. I couldn't speak correctly. I couldn't put my thoughts together. And I, the very first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I walked into, it was a straight meeting. I have no idea how I found it or how I got there. My privilege to drive had been taken away a long time ago, so I obviously took the bus. I don't remember. I don't remember who I asked. I don't remember anything about it. But I walked into a meeting at Moore Park in the San Fernando Valley, and I sat on the front row, and I had on my armor. I love when new people come in with sunglasses or motorcycle jackets. I had a fishing hat and a yellow rain slicker. They still talk about it. I said, I don't, they said it wasn't even raining. Well, you just came in with my synapses were not firing. I was out of bed. I was dressed. What else do you, else do you want? But I, you know, I sat down at that meeting and they called on me to share, and the oddest thing happened. I think because I have a lot of training as an actor and I have a lot of training in front of people, I could speak. It's the weirdest thing. I think it'd be the opposite newcomer, that you would think, well, I could talk to another person, but I couldn't get up and talk. But for some reason, when you asked me to speak on a group level, I could speak. And I was scared to death that you were going to try to talk to me one-on-one. But anyway, they called on me to share, and I shared, and I'd just gotten out of jail. I had a lot of shame about that. No one in my family had been to jail. I was sentenced to 120 days. I told my mother I was going to the Betty Ford Center, and I would call her from the jail, and she told my sisters, boy, they're loud at that Betty Ford Center. She said, they're so loud. But I had been sentenced to 120 days, and I got out of jail, and I went into this AA meeting, and I shared, and we clap, you know, and I'm an actor, and I, you know, I got a little ray of hope, just about this much. I sat down, and then they called on Big Mike, this big straight guy from Brooklyn, to wrap it up, and from the back, Mike goes to the young lady that just got out of jail. And the meeting just went dead silent. And people were going, Mikey, that's not a lady. That's a guy. But, you know, when I get nervous, I'm not exactly a pillar of masculinity anyway, and my voice gets in the upper register. And I just wanted, you know, I thought of all things to happen. You know, I was so humiliated and so horrified. No matter what your button is, maybe you grew up poor. You know, wherever that shame comes from, maybe you grew up fat. I grew up a sissy. You know, and I've had so much shame around that. And for that to happen, I thought, well, AA's not for me. This publicly humiliates you. So I tried to get out this door, and that guy went out that door and caught me. This big guy from Brooklyn, and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, I hope you don't think that I was making fun of you. He said, I don't hear well. I was in the back. You had that hat on, and I said, you know, it happens quite a bit. I get it on the telephone all the time. You know, ma'am, I'm not a ma'am. I'm a sir. I'm a gay sir, but I'm a sir, and so. He said something, you know, we forget when we're around this room with our slogans and everything that there may be someone that walks into AA, I had never heard this. I had never heard, he said, I hope you keep coming back. And I was so taken aback. First of all, you know, I have this Southern mother where manners are of the utmost, and I thought I had to RSVP. So it was such a quandary, you know. If when someone invites you, you... And he said, I hope you keep coming back. And that was October 20th, 1997, you know. And I said to him, okay, you know. And he said, I'd like to, you know, maybe meet you here tomorrow. And I said, okay. And that was what came me back. Now, very quickly, they somehow tricked me. This is a meeting where you have a different secretary every single day, even though it's in one building, therefore it's not like a clubhouse, therefore you have a different cleanup person every single day. Somehow they led me to believe that it was my job to mop the floors, that I had taken the cleanup commitment. And I was so scared of speaking to people. It was sort of divine as I look back, because if you tried to talk to me, I would say, I'd love to talk, but, you know, I'm the cleanup person. And I would run. Listen, y'all, the only time I've ever been in the closet, I would go into the mop closet, sit on that little rolling yellow thing, and listen till everybody left. And the layout is very similar to this room. These windows are ceiling to floor and look out onto a garden, and it was very quiet, and everybody had left. And I had never mopped in my life. On television, I had seen that S thing, you know, like that. And so I would start right here with my little rolling yellow mop bucket, and it was quiet, and the birds were singing, and there was nobody around. And I would mop from there to there, and then I would empty, and I would just think about what I'd heard in the meeting. And that was the best that I could do. It's the best I could do. You know, but I had to be there because I was the mop person. That's why commitments are so important. And let me tell you a little something about self-esteem. You get your self-esteem back by doing esteemable acts, and you do not have to be Mother Teresa, you know, lying with the lepers. I got my self-esteem back because I took really good care. I was the cleanup person. It was my job. And when I was about 6 months sober, the two ladies that run the church came in, made a special trip. I was in there mopping, and they said, you know, we've had AA meetings here for 20-some-odd years. We've never had anybody keep this place so nice. We want to thank you. And I had to go in the bathroom because I couldn't quit crying, you know. And I have had this huge life. I'm telling you, in the 1980s, I had the series. I had six-figure salary. I had, you know, and I was more proud of how I had kept that room than anything I'd ever done in my life. And then I got a little out of hand. I kept, like, fagging it up. I wanted to. I tried to get them to buy curtains, and they wouldn't dip into the. I said, this place is a dump. But when I was a year sober, they gave me a mop with a big bow. And, you know, by the time I was 5 years sober, I remember thinking, I don't have that newcomer feeling. I went back and I took that commitment. I mopped, you know. I mopped for a while. But the big struggle, and I'll jump into this, has been the whole God thing. I really do believe, because of what happened to me as a child, and I do not want in any way to offend anyone. I'm not one of these people that says I'm a recovering Southern Baptist or any of that. If anything, this program has taught me a very deep reverence for anyone's spiritual path. But for this alcoholic, telling a boy, especially one who fell out of the womb into his mother's high heels, that deep within the earth is a red man with horns stoking a fire for people who sin, I think that is spiritual abuse. And I think it borders on child abuse. You know, I have wrestled with the devil for half my life. You know, I really did. I was baptized 14 times. Every time the preacher would say, come forward, lost sinner, I'd go. For those of you who don't know, in the Baptist church, you get baptized. I mean, we immerse. And so, you know, you do it once, and then you've got your ticket to heaven. You're saved. Well, I'd go every week. My mother would say, son, remain seated. You're already saved. But I couldn't help it. I had so much fear of that lake of fire. And I'll tell you what, the very first time, that fear stuck with me all the way into adulthood. The first time that I took ecstasy, I was at this bar called The Probe. And we, for those of you that don't know, it's a leather bar. And I was fresh off the turnip truck. We were at the black party. We did all this ecstasy and decided we were going to go to the black party and see what it was all about. I was wearing button-down Oxford cloth shirts, penny loafers with no socks, and khaki pants. I stuck out like a rat turd on rice in the middle of all those leather queens. But I have to tell y'all, I'll tell you a little secret. I am fascinated with leather queens. I really am. All that effort. It's exhausting. All that effort to look so butch, and then they open their mouths and 40 yards of purple chiffon come flying out. But I was sitting in the probe tripping on ecstasy, and I remember hundreds and maybe even thousands of beautiful gay men dancing in the probe. See, you walk in and you look down on the dance floor. So I'm sort of like this, and there's thousands of them, you know, in all kinds of decadent attire, you know, chaps with their heinies just hanging out the back, and all kinds of drug-induced stupors, and they're dancing and waving their arms, and I'm just kind of watching, and all of a sudden, every light on the dance floor went red, and I saw it, y'all. No, I saw the lake of fire. And it was a sea of burning cocksuckers, just far as... And listen, this is a true story. I took off running. My friends didn't know what happened. I screamed, and I ran all the way up Highland. I took a left on Sunset, and I'm telling you, when the sun came up, I was still running from the devil. I was running. I ran almost all the way to the ocean. I was so scared of that devil. And you know, I'm telling you right now, on that walk home, I think is the first time that I thought, you know what? I'm not going to do this anymore. You know, I am not going to do this anymore. I am no longer going to wrestle with the devil. And so I walked into the program, and all of a sudden, my first meeting, you know, I heard this God thing, and it reminded me a little bit of Sunday school because of the way they're always in churches. And I just remember thinking, so it's come to this. And here they started talking about this God, and there was one woman I used to talk to all the time. Her name was Miss Jane Gray. I love the old broads in AA. You know, those ones that just, you know, sit down, honey. I spilt more than you drank. Now you sit there and shut up. Sit there and shut up. Because, see, if you're the kind of drug addict and alcoholic I am, you learn to be charming. I can charm. You can't charm those old broads. Mm-mm. They could care less. And this Miss Jane Gray, she was the one person I could talk to. And I'd talk to her all the time. I'd say, Miss Gray, it doesn't make sense to me. You know, I'm very suspicious of Jonah and the whale, that story. And I said, you know, I just flat out don't believe about that woman that looked back and turned into salt. That just, you know, I just see these as allegorical metaphors. You know, like a wonderful teaching device. But I don't believe it. And see, she's the first person that told me. She said, honey, religion is for people who are afraid of going to hell. Spirituality is for people who've already been. See, you don't need to worry about going to hell, honey. You've been to hell and back. You know, let's just worry about getting you on a spiritual path. And she said to me, I want you to go home, and on your bathroom mirror, I want you to take a bar of soap, and I want you to write H-E-L-P. Write it on your mirror. Now, what that stands for is his or her ever loving presence. And in the morning, I just want you to say help while you're shaving. I said, but Miss Grace, see, here's the problem. I don't know who I'm saying it to. I don't believe anybody's like, ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. She said, you need to shut up, okay? Because I'm telling you something to do. She said, I want you to just say help. Just put it out there. She said, then when you go through your day, if you get a little squirrely, and I loved that word. That is the perfect word for a tweaker. I'm getting a little squirrely here. She said, when you get a little squirrely, I want you to find a quiet place. She said, I used to have to lock myself in the toilet stall. But just find somewhere quiet, and I want you to breathe. Take a big old breath, deep breath in. Cool air. See? cool air. Now breathe out. Warm air. See, baby, that's life. And I want you to say help. At the end of the day, I want you to take a washcloth. I want you to wash off help. And I want you to write thank you. Go to bed. Your life's going to get better. And you know what? It did. You had to give me, I don't know what makes me such a doubting Thomas. I think that I'm spiritually damaged, first of all. When I hear people talk about, well, I wasn't raised in any real religion, I think, God, you're so ahead of me. You are so ahead of me. You know, they seem like that's not a good thing. Like, I just walked in here and I had no religion. I think, oh, honey, you don't know what I've had to just discard. You know, just what I've had to discard. And so it worked for me. You know, that worked for me. But the wonderful part about Alcoholics Anonymous is that our concept of a God can grow and can change as we grow and change. And so that worked for a while, and then it didn't work. I'm 3 years sober, and I'm bereft again. And I'm just, it doesn't make, and I hear people talk about this daily conscious contact. I get up in the morning, do the third step prayer to the walls. Oh, I just can't surrender. I can't. And so I finally, at that 5 year point, when I got to 5 years sober, and I ended up in the fetal position of that newcomer that I'd sleep in the bed with but not have sex, I finally called Don Norman, my sponsor, and I said, you know what, I've never done this in sobriety, but I'm going to cut and run. I said, I cannot take this pain, Don. I'm going to drive to Texas. I promise you I'm not going to drink. I promise you I'm not going to use. I'll go to meetings there, but I have got to get out of here. I cannot be around this boy. And I'm going to drive to Texas, and my friend has a house on Lake Arlington. He's going to let me stay there. And I've got to get over this boy. And I drove all the way to Texas. My friend Wayne, who's not in the program, walked out the door, and he could just see the pain on my face. He said, honey, I'd love to take you to church. I said, I'd rather get beat with a stick. I said, Wayne, I grew up in the church. I was spoon-fed the Bible. I don't believe a word of it. Blah, blah, blah. He said, Leslie, just go with me to church. We end up going out to this Richland Hills Church of Christ. It was big as a shopping mall. Thousands of people. Big screens where you could see the preacher. And the Church of Christ is one of the largest Protestant denominations in the country. I'd never heard of it. You know, they don't believe in pianos or organs. Mm-mm. Make a joyful noise unto the Lord, but it does not say with a pen or an organ, and that is of the devil. And so, and once again, I'm not making fun. If you're, you know, this was just my journey. Because I was there to scoff. So the choir comes out, but because they couldn't have pianos or organs, they sang a cappella in four-part harmony. It was like angels. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard in my life. So then the preacher started. Same old shit. Come forward, lost sinners. Whoop the aisle. Blah, blah, blah. And I thought, so I'm looking around like, you know, somebody to nudge, well, you believe this shit. You know, I wanted to find somebody who's going to scoff with me. I've been baptized 14 times. I don't believe this shit. But, you know, the weirdest thing happened. I started looking around at the faces of all those people. Thousands of people, and I got so sad because I thought, my God, they believe with just childlike faith, you know, what I would give to be able to put on my little polyester suit and go to the Richland Hills Church of Christ every Sunday morning and just lay my burdens down. But how do I embrace something that does not embrace me? You know, this is not my journey. And so I got back to L.A. and I heard something really simple. Hector got up, wonderful Hector, 35 years sobriety. He got up to the podium and he said, I have a God who does not do for me or to me. My God only shines through me. And I chewed on that. I would call him. He would just pick up that phone. And I'd say, Hector, what do you mean your God doesn't do for you? He said, well, they taught me in AA to not pray for specifics. I don't go to my God. He said, see, my God is just this amazing sort of all-encompassing, non-punishing light. You know, love can't cure cancer, baby. I don't go to my God. Ask him, please cure cancer. Love can't stop people from getting molested, children. Love can't stop, you know, people from flying airplanes into buildings, you know. I don't go to my God for any of that. You taught me in AA how to pray. That third step prayer, you told me to not pray for specifics. I offer myself to the light. I offer myself to thee to do with me as thou wilt. He said, my God doesn't do for me. I don't go to my God. Your God may be able to get you a parking spot. Mine can't. You know, I don't go to him for that. I don't think I can. Love can get me a parking spot. You know, it's just love. Love, love, this amazing light. And he said, but here's where the program comes in, baby. He said, you got to keep that channel open. You've got to keep that conduit open. And he said, that's why we write and we do our daily 10th steps. We write because it slows our mind down to the speed of a pen and we get clarity. We write about our fears. We write about our resentments. And we write about our sexual misconduct. I love that term. It's so polite. Let me tell you something, baby. When you've been up 6 days on crystal, it's some real sick shit. But if you want to call it my sexual misconduct. But you know what? This stuff was written, y'all, in the 1930s. But I think if that doesn't describe a gay man riddled with fear, riddled with resentments, and our sexual misconduct, and newcomer, that those are the three things that will take you out, especially the third. It has been my experience, sexual misconduct. And I have to tell you, what my sponsor told me is what I tell my sponsees. And I say, you want to do 90 meetings in 90 days? Why don't you do no sex in 90 days? Because, baby, you've had enough. And there is not a tombstone on the face of this earth that says he died from horniness. And as Don Norman said to me, baby, you will not believe what you can accomplish when you're not hunting dick 24 hours a day. And so, you know, that's what, you know, the whole sexual misconduct thing. But we write that to keep the conduit open so that that light can shine. See, I today just want to be in the sunlight of the Spirit. You know, I am so reverent of other spiritual paths. I'll garner a little bit. I've been out with the Hindus and Ganesh I chanted with the Buddhists for a full year. We said, Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. And I said to them, well, what am I chanting for? And they said, just whatever is going to bring you, you know, the light, happiness. And so for a full year, I chanted, Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, get my ass on the Letterman show. It didn't work. But you know, and when I go home to Tennessee, my sweet mother, God bless her, my mother, you know, my mother will never be a Betty DeGeneres. My mother will never march in P-flag parades with a little sign that says, I'm the proud mother of a homosexual. It ain't going to happen. She's of another generation. And you know what you taught me? If I am expecting my mother to accept me exactly as I am, then I have to give her the same. And I have to know that this is not a woman. This is a woman who will go to her grave a little ashamed about the whole gay thing. And you know what? My mom and I have the most wonderful relationship because I no longer, you know. I remember I had this cowboy boyfriend, 6'3". And my mother, I'd been with him forever. My mother would call and say, how's your little friend? I said, well, he's fine. She couldn't even say, she said, well, what are you and your little friend going to do for Thanksgiving? I finally said, Mother, he's my lover. She said, I'm just going to sit here and think about yellow daisies. I'm not, she said, I'm just, but, you know, I'm no longer like that around. I'm a good son, and she invited me this Christmas to go to church with her, and it meant so much to take her son, who's on television and won an Emmy, and take him to the church and show me off, and I did exactly like you guys taught me. I garnered what I could, and I left the rest under the pew in front of me. And all that, whatever it was, you know, that awful place where I was baptized and, you know, that was gone. I just went to church with my mother. You know, I just went to church with my mother because I'm a good son today. And I'm going to wrap it up with this. When I When I was about 4 years sober, I was writing one day, and I remembered something. This is so... In 1982, I had, I suppose, what you would call a true religious experience. This is years before, you know, conversations with God. I had grown up, I love this, the two little queers in that Baptist church found one another. With all those kids, those two little queer boys found each other. He's my best friend in the whole wide world. And we harbored a shameful, shameful secret. Now, I know y'all are thinking the secret. We harbored that too, but do you know that when we were little and nobody was home, my little friend and I would dress up in my mother's clothes. We didn't know what drag queens were. We were 6, 7, 8 years old. We'd put on my mother's clothes because my mother, I didn't have a shot, y'all. My mother was the perfect mother for a gay man. The poly, little pillbox hats and Jackie Kennedy, you know, that hair kind of, you know, with the Diana Ross kind of flip, but and we would dress up in my mother's clothes, and she had fabulous clothes, and we would take a hairbrush and we would pretend that we were Diana Ross and the Supremes. The shame of it all. And we I was always Diana. I remember I would tell him, "Are you gonna be the backup girl? Well, back the fuck up." I was going to be Diana. And we were best friends all the way through high school. And do you know, as we got older, we never once, as I recall, ever mentioned what we did when we were little boys. It was so shameful. Now, he took a much different path than I did. He got married. He married the prettiest girl in my church. He married the richest girl in my church. And they were married for a couple of years. And then I heard through the grapevine that they got a divorce, and he disappeared. You know, that happens so much in the South. You know, to come out, you just have to leave, you know. You just disappear. He disappeared. 20 years later, I'm walking down the street in West Hollywood, and there's my best friend that I grew up with. I said, "Where have you been?" He said, "Honey, I've been having a homo hoedown." Now, this was 81 or 82, and he was the very first person I knew personally to be diagnosed with the AIDS virus. And y'all, it was terrifying. You know, most of you, you know, some of you are old enough to remember, you know, I buried an entire phone directory in the 1980s. I buried an entire phone directory. And when you'd visit somebody in the hospital, you had to wear an entire space suit. You had to wear gloves and everything. And I don't know, I was doing a lot of crystal at the time, but I was fearless. I would sit with him. You know, people would say to me, "Leslie, you are such a martyr. Honey, you just sit with him all night long." I thought, what else do I have to do? You know, I got a rail of crystal in the bathroom. It's either that or go home, beat off to porno. So I would just sit with him. We would sit together. And I'd let him smoke cigarettes. He was on oxygen. I'd tell him, "Be careful of that tank, girl. You'll blow us to kingdom come." But here we were. He would have IVs off both arms, and we're sitting there with the window open, you know, me watching for the nurse and smoking those cigarettes, and we would talk and giggle and just catch up, but he went crazy. You know, we didn't know back then what we know now, that sometimes there really is serious dementia involved. I just thought he'd gone bonkers. He began to rattle incessantly, just night after night with there was no segue. But, you know, I was tweaking so hard, a lot of it made sense, you know. Yeah, I'm with you on that one, girl. But one night, it was about 5 o'clock in the morning, and he had finally quieted down, you know. He had finally just given up, and I was sitting there smoking my last cigarette, staring out the window, waiting for those goddamn birds to start chirping. And all of a sudden, from over in the dark, I heard this really tiny voice, and he said, "Leslie, do you think I'm being punished? I said, girl, I'm tweaking. Because, you know, that was what the preachers in the Deep South were saying. It was a tumultuous time for gay men who had been raised in the church. But you know what? It made sense to me when they were saying this was God's way of eradicating the earth of homosexuals. It was so frightening. And in his dementia, it became his mantra. He was like a parrot over and over. Do you think I'm being punished? And no matter how many times I would try to reason with him, I would say, you know, because I read, you just read everything you could get your hands on. And you just, and I said, look, they're leaning towards it. It's a virus. I do not think that this is a moral issue. And he would just, you know, do you think I'm being punished? Do you think I'm being punished? 3 days before he died, he sat up in bed and looked around. He was as lucid as I had ever seen him. And he said, Leslie, the most amazing thing has happened. He said, I prayed last night and God spoke to me. Well, y'all, I grew up in the Baptist church. Please, we heard that all the time. And then it spoke to me. Woo! We got the devil on the run. So I just told him, I said, oh, girl, I'm just tickle pig. I can't wait to hear what he said. So, you know, just right over my head. But you know what? I'm telling you right now. My friend was like a little burned up French fry. He was just a little tiny bag of bones. He took my wrist and he pulled me down onto the bed with what seemed like superhuman strength. And he said, Leslie, it's important that you listen because I heard him. I heard him with these ears in this body, on this plane of existence. I heard the voice of God. And Leslie, it's so simple. You see, first of all, the soul has no gender. So when it's all said and done, it is not about whom one loved that's important. What's important, Leslie, is the quality of that love. See, we're on this earth for one reason and one reason only, and that is to give quality love on a daily basis. I was 4 years sober, you know, when I remembered all that. And I thought, if that isn't the program, you know, I keep it really simple today. Did my friend hear God? I don't know. You know, I'm such a doubter. I'm such a doubting Thomas. You know, I think he heard what he needed to hear so he could die in peace. I don't know. You know, today I want to live in the sunlight of the Spirit. I want, you know, to let that light shine through me, you know. And so I keep the channel open. I do believe that because I'm a gay man who made it through the excesses, I was a hippie first, made it through that, you know, made it through the 70s with the, you know, Elton John platform boots, and I looked like a little rock and roll troll doll. I just had all this... all this long hair. I made it through the 70s and the discos. I made it through the 80s and all the cocaine and making all that money. And I made it through the 90s and I'm buried. You know, I'm here and I'm sober and there's a reason. You know, there's a reason. And so that's why when wonderful people like Jim ask me to speak, I come. I have an amazing life. I wish I could sit down. I'm one who got the cash and prizes. You know, I won an Emmy this year and 9 years ago I was unemployable. Completely unemployable. But I have to tell you, I no longer believe in the devil. But if the devil was standing right here and said, okay, here it is, you can keep that Emmy and you can keep that series that you've got with Lily Tomlin that's starting on HBO. Just getting a little plug. And you can keep that series that starts, you know, in January 2008 on HBO called 12 Miles of Bad Road with you, Lily Tomlin, and Mary Kay Place. written by Linda Bloodworth Thomason, who wrote Designing Women. You can keep all of that, but Leslie, what you cannot keep is that deep, deep sense of who you are, of what you are, that amazing ability. You know, I am closer right now to my authentic self than I've ever been, you know, and I'm a work in progress, and I wish I could sit with each of you new people and say, stick with us. All your dreams are going to come true. You might even win an Emmy. We don't promise that. We don't promise that. It's a daily reprieve. A daily reprieve that is contingent upon your spiritual maintenance. That's all we promise. But I can tell you this, if you do not stick with us, none of your dreams will come true. I think that's a given. So I think what we offer in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we even that playing field for people like us that are in remission from this disease. You know, it gives us a shot. And I encourage all of you to dream really big. And I thank you so much for letting me speak.